On our desert island this week is the novelist and scientist C.P. Snow, Lord Snow. Lord Snow, does music play an important part in your life?
I wish it did, but I have to come quite clean and say that it doesn't. I'm musically deficient. It's been a grief to me all my life. But I can't help it. It probably is a natural deficiency.
Your father was a musician, wasn't he?
He was a church organist, yes.
So how did you set about choosing your 8 records?
Well, I had to make a vow I wouldn't come on false pretenses, as you know, and so I've chosen things which have meant something to me, not through musical reasons, but through free associations of various kinds, often literary.
Yes. Where do we start? What's the first one?
Well, this is an obvious example. I'm going to choose the Sonata for Violin and Piano in D minor by Saint-Saëns, just to reveal the little phrase, the petite phrase, which is so important in the love affair between Swann and Odette at the beginning of Proust's great novel.
À la recherche du temps.
À la recherche, and of course the title of this part is Du côté de chez Swann. And this little phrase, which I believe is not musically interesting, but that to me is neither here nor there, was called by them the national anthem of their love affair. That's the phrase they constantly use. And whenever Swann heard it, then it brought back the whole of this emotion.
Famous little phrase from the Saint-Saëns Sonata for Violin and Piano in D minor. What's your second record?
My second record, here I'm a bit nearer my home ground. This is a part of the orchard scene from Act 3, Scene 2 of Henry IV, Part 2, when Sir John Falstaff is meeting an old acquaintance, Mr. Justice Shallow, and they've known each other as very young men, long, long ago, 50-odd years ago. And I think to any aging man, this means something. We've heard the chimes at midnight ourselves, and this brings back one's disreputable youth.
There is 2 more call than your number. You must have but 4 here, sir. And so I pray you go in with me to dinner.
Come, I will go drink with you, but I cannot tarry dinner. I am glad to see you, by my truth, Master Shallow.
Oh, Sir John, do you remember since we lay all night in the windmill in St. George's Field?
No more of that, good Master Shallow. No more of that.
It was a merry night. And is Jane Nightwork alive?
She lives, Master Shallow.
She never could away with me.
Never, never. She would always say she could not abide Master Shallow.
By the mass, I could anger her to the heart. She was then a bona roba. Does she hold her own well?
Old, old, Master Shallow.
She must be old. She cannot choose but be old. Certain, she's old. And had Robin Nightwork, my old Nightwork, before I came to Clemens Inn.
That's 55 years ago.
A scene from Shakespeare's King Henry IV, Part 2, from a production directed by Peter Wood. Lord Snow, you began your education in Leicester. Were you born there?
Yes, yes.
And you won scholarships to University College Leicester and to Cambridge. What did you read?
I read chemistry and physics.
What had you in mind? Industry or...?
No, I always knew that I wanted to write books, but I thought the books I wanted to write meant that I had to nose my way among people and things before I could write them decently. So therefore I had to do something else to start with.
Yes.
And I had a tiny talent for science, very tiny, but enough to mean that I could probably become some sort of professional. Mm-hmm. And so I did it that way.
It was always novels that you wanted to write?
Always novels, yeah.
Now, you stayed on in Cambridge for some postgraduate research.
Yes, and I became a don.
Yes.
And did a certain amount of research.
And at the age of 25, you wrote your first book. What was that?
That was a detective story called Death Under Sail. That was to get my hand in. Remember, mm-hmm. I'd been doing professional science for a while, and so I wasn't easy enough on the page to begin with.
Yes.
That was a useful discipline. And then I wrote a perfectly ordinary straight novel called The Search, which is about the scientific life. And then I got on to my major work.
Yes, this very ambitious sequence of novels, which I'd like to talk to you about later in more detail. Your writing was interrupted during the war years when you took on an administrative job.
Well, that's putting it mildly. I couldn't write a word for 5 years, which is quite a long stretch, remember, at a time when one should be somewhere near one's most proficient.
Yes, what were you doing?
I was really organising scientific personnel. Someone, in fact, Sir Lawrence Bragg, had the bright idea, as I was supposed to know something about people and a little about science, I might deal with scientific people.
Mm-hmm.
Which is surprisingly sensible, and I think it was certainly useful for me, and I think I could do a reasonable job.
It was work that involved a great deal of travelling.
Enormous amount. I must have seen every university in England 3 times a year for 5 years.
Yes. And after that, after the war, you held various civil service posts, followed by a spell in government.
I was civil service commissioner. It rather followed on from what I'd been doing in the war.
Yes.
And then I had a spell in government, that's quite true.
As parliamentary secretary to the Ministry of Technology.
Yeah.
How did you take to political life?
I didn't like it much, but I thought I'd been a backroom boy for a long while and been saying things in private and would ought to stand up and say some things in public. And I told the Prime Minister I'd do it as a matter of duty for a year. I did it for nearly two. I thought that was an honest bargain.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it provided very good background material for your other self, for the writer.
Well, we mustn't talk about that.
And now, of course, you confine your activities to writing.
Exactly, entirely.
I think we've got to record number 3. What's that to be?
That is to be a thing which is called variously the Canadian boat song or the Hebridean boat song. And the reason I chose that was partly it's a classical demonstration of nostalgia. I've never been to the Hebrides, let me hasten to add, and I do know Canada fairly well, and I can't help feeling Canada's a nice place to feel nostalgia in about some rather bleak island. However, it is passionate and real nostalgia. But also, I confess that when the Hebrides, with singular unanimity or near unanimity, voted against the European Community, I like to think of some Hebridean civil servant in Brussels now singing the Hebridean boat song.
From the lone sheiling of the misty island, mountains divide us and the waste of seas. Yet still the blood is strong, the heart is Highland, and we in dream behold the Hebrides.
The voice of John Laurie. Now, the long sequence of novels which you planned, 11 books under the generic title Strangers and Brothers. When did you conceive the idea and what really inspired it?
I can give you a very curious answer to that. I conceived the idea at 8:30 in the evening on January the 1st, 1935. These things don't usually happen like that, but it did happen that way.
How can you pinpoint it so exactly?
Oh, I remember it quite exactly, and in fact there is documentary evidence, because I wrote to someone saying I'd think I know now what I'm going to do.
It was a gigantic project, a literary project. One thinks of a few French writers, Balzac and Proust and Romain Rolland. Is there anyone who's written anything comparable in English before?
Not, I think, before I started, no. There were one or two things of the same nature since, but certainly not before I started.
Which years do the novels encompass?
1914 is the actual first scene, and they go on till about 1965 or 6, that sort of time.
Are they all in the first person?
All in the first person.
What do they have in the way of a common quality or intention?
The common quality was intended to be saying what the narrator, who in this case speaks for me about what he knows, what he's found out about people, what he's discovered about people, and as a secondary theme, about people in society, about the bits of society that he happens to know, which is very roughly professional England, but it's a fairly wide stratum of professional England.
Yes. You've had the satisfaction of having coined a phrase which has passed into the language.
I suppose that's true. It's okay. You mean Corridors of Power?
The Corridors of Power.
Yes. Well, that's pure accident. I wrote it quite casually and forgot. I had forgotten about it. It isn't even a chapter title. But Rainer Heppenstall, giving a rather long review in the Times Literary Supplement, headed his review Corridors of Power. And then, to my astonishment, it caught on almost all over the literate world, so to speak. It happens to translate very easily into almost any language. Mm-hmm. Russians use exactly the same phrase for the book called by that title, and so on. And now I find Corridors of Power cropping up. If I had a small royalty on that, I should be quite well off.
Yes. Record number four.
Record number four is the 23rd Psalm. And I've chosen this for two reasons. First, it's very beautiful, as read by Lord Olivier. Secondly, it's not quite right. That is, when the Psalms, like the rest of the authorized version, were translated, they were using, of course, a text which was mainly slightly anachronistic, even by the standards of 1611. It was really based on 1550-ish translations, or earlier. Marvellous English. But though they were quite good at their scholarship, our knowledge of Hebrew, even of Greek, has increased very considerably since that time. And so the actual literal record isn't exact in the light of our contemporary knowledge. Now, in the one that we shall hear, that doesn't matter very much, because it's a song. It isn't quite right. For instance, the Valley of the Shadow of Death should certainly be the Valley Dark as Death. The Valley of the Shadow of Death is something we've all had running through our heads as part of the collective unconscious for hundreds of years, but it isn't quite right. I was brought up in the Church of England. I'm not a believer, and therefore I hanker after the liturgy and the words that I heard as a boy. And I think this is true of many people. If I were a believer, I think I should feel differently. Not on this, because here the song is so beautiful you can take it. But where it really bears on real religious truth, and where the translation is clearly wrong, then I think it's non-believers who hanker most passionately after the past verbal beauties, and believers who are more interested in the truth.
Here we have the reassurance of the old familiar version.
That's right, yes.
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. And I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever.
Laurence Olivier. You're married to another distinguished novelist, Pamela Hansford-Johnston.
Yes.
Do you discuss your work with each other?
Oh, yes. She can do many things I can't, and I can do some things she can't. And so the interchange has been useful to us both.
Are you a disciplined writer? Do you work regular hours or a certain number of words each day?
All professional writers have to be disciplined, certainly if they write long novels. You've got to sit on your bottom to write a novel, as someone once said. And so you have to write for several hours a day.
Do you plan a novel in great detail before you start?
I like to have the whole conception in my mind, and usually I have it planned in detail, but not absolutely always. That has varied a bit. But the real answer to your question is yes, I do. I do plan carefully.
Do you write in longhand?
Yes. Horrible longhand, which involves great difficulty in getting typed.
Four or five of your novels have been dramatized by Ronald Miller. The case in question is running at the Theatre Royal Haymarket at the moment. Now, I know you and your wife have adapted a Bulgarian novel for the theatre. Why haven't you adapted your own novels?
Two answers, I think. One is that if you've thought of any literary thing in one form, it's very hard to transform it into another. Secondly, I think I really haven't got the knack or the skill or the art whatever it is that makes a play work on the stage. It's not easy, you know. It's something that I think I'd have liked to have done at one time, but I got too set in my ways.
Well, record number five, what's that?
Record number five is Were I Laid on Greenland Shores in the Beggar's Opera. Beggar's Opera is a sort of rather simple thing that I can understand. But also, I really wanted it for the same reason that I chose the 23rd Psalm. I think it's been prettified. I think the Beggar's Opera has been prettified rather too much. In fact, a good deal too much. This is, I think, now general opinion confirms that. I'm sure, almost sure, that when the original audiences saw it, it must have seemed much harsher. Probably not as harsh as Brecht's Threepenny Opera, which of course was drawn from it, but a good deal nearer Brecht than it is to the thing we see. I'm aware this pretty song is an example in point.
Were I laid on Greenland's coast, and in my arms embraced my lass, warm amidst eternal frost, too soon the his night would pass.
Were I sold on Indian soil, soon as the burning day was close, I could more fast and meet my when on my charmer's breast before.
I would love you more than
every night would kiss.
A duet from the Beggar's Opera, sung by Elsie Morrison and John Cameron. What next?
Oh, the next one is Kutuzov's great song from War and Peace.
From the Prokofiev War
from
and Peace.
From the Prokofiev War and Peace. I saw this at the Bolshoi many years ago, not too long after the war, and it was intensely moving. I mean, this great song, which is really saying that we shall have to go back behind Moscow. This is what Kutuzov is telling his generals at a council. But in the long run, Russia will prevail. The strength of our people, their courage, the whole Russian people, that is, the words are in the song, says just that. And almost everyone in that audience was feeling that they'd had the same experience, and there weren't many dry eyes in the house.
Возможет враг побед, подчинит сердца храбрых больных людей. Вся усеется русская земля, неприятеля косми. Победит врага наш великий народ.
An aria from Prokofiev's War and Peace, sung by Alexei Grifchenyuk. Can you think of any way in which your scientific training would help you as a castaway?
I really don't think so. I'm not very good at looking after myself. I think I should be a most incompetent castaway.
Oh, dear. What are you going to live on?
Ah. Have I got to catch my own food?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Or cultivate it, or...
I suppose. Suppose I could learn some primitive form of fishing if I had remotest practical equipment.
Yes.
Cultivation, I think I should find very difficult. No, I think I wouldn't give much for my life.
What about navigation? Would you try to escape?
No, I think it depends where I went or where I was cast away, but I think not.
I think you're wise. Let's have record number seven.
Record number seven is The Farmer and the Carman Should Be Friends from Oklahoma.
the farmer and the cowman should be friends. Oh, the farmer and the cowman should be friends. One man likes to push a plow, the other likes to chase a cow, but that's no reason why they can't be friends. Territory folks should stick together, territory folks should all be pals. Cowboys dance with the farmer's daughters, farmers dance with the rancher's gals.
Territory folks should stick together, territory folks should all be pals. Cowboys dance with the farmer's daughters, farmers dance.
The Farmer and the Cowman, from the soundtrack of the film of Oklahoma. And now we come to your last record. What's that?
My last record is the choral movement in Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. And that is partly because the Ninth Symphony is the national anthem of the European community, of which I was and am a very strong supporter. And I've started with one national anthem, the national anthem of Swan's Love for Odette. And I thought I'd finish with another national anthem of a slightly larger kind. But also there's a private joke. Owing to my musical imbecility, lots of loving friends, male and women, have tried to educate me. And they usually have tried to educate me by trying to teach me how to pick out the themes in the Ninth Symphony. I remember a sarcastic female voice, "Are you still trying to learn the themes of the Ninth?" And that has trickled down over the years.
Part of the last movement of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. If you could take just one disc of your eight, which would it be?
Ah, that would certainly be the Orchard Scene from Henry IV, Part Two. It seems to me one of the simplest and most beautiful bits of a work of art that I know. I'm sure Shakespeare did it almost without thought. That's the kind of thing which a great writer does without the slightest trouble. And it just is immortal.
And one luxury to take to the island with you.
Well, if you call it a luxury, I should like lots and lots of paper, lots and lots of writing books, and a fair supply of biros. I've thought about this, but I don't think there's any point in taking a work of art, however great.
Business as usual.
Business as usual.
And one book, apart from the Bible, Shakespeare, and big encyclopedias.
In the same spirit, I should choose something where I could do some work. I should choose a Russian grammar and try and learn the language properly.
Right. And thank you, Lord Snow, C.P. Snow, for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
Thank you very much.
Goodbye, everyone.